Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, November 25th, 2016. Did Ethiopia's and Sudan's rejection of Riek Machar actually strengthen his position?
That sense of unfair treatment of Dr. Riek Machar can actually play into a recruiting drive for people who feel the same across South Sudan, but more especially from people of his own ethnic base.
And rebels fighting in Sudan vowed to stop using child soldiers.
Many times have been children involved in the rebel movement in Darfur and in the SPLA North. Now we are glad that they stopped this and they signed. And if practical team, they didn't do this, it's a good thing actually.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A legal expert on South Sudan says the move by Ethiopia and Sudan to block Riek Machar's entry will fuel even more conflict in South Sudan. Remember Mia Mingi, a lecturer of law at the University of Pretoria in South Africa, tells South Sudan in Focus host John Tanza that Sudan and Ethiopia are acting on instructions from top U.S. government officials, and any attempt to sideline the former first vice president will only complicate the search for peace in South Sudan.
That sense of unfair treatment of Dr. Riek Machar can actually play into a recruiting drive for people who feel the same across South Sudan, but more especially from people of his own ethnic base.
The Sudanese authorities accepted him to stay in Khartoum on medical ground. And then he has also been staying in Ethiopia for quite a long time. In fact, he has a home there in Ethiopia. Why would you think these two countries changed their approach towards Machar?
I can only speculate at the moment, because when John Kerry stood in Nairobi...
You mean the U.S. Secretary of State?
Yes, the U.S. Secretary of State. When he stood in Nairobi and indicated that the replacement of Riek Machar was legal, and then the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, again testifying before the U.S. Congress, said that it was not wise for Dr. Riek Machar to return to South Sudan. What one will make out of that is an American policy position towards South Sudan that want to find a solution to the problem in South Sudan without Dr. Riek Machar.
The message from the international community has always been consistent that the two leaders of the warring parties must end the violence. Now that Machar is facing difficulties getting back to South Sudan, what is the international community doing with President Kiir?
For the first time, I see the region and international community in love with the dictator, because you see that what the action of the region and international community is doing right now is it is emboldened government by ensuring that it is intention of silencing critique, of ensuring that South Sudanese do not speak in Kenya or in Ethiopia or in Uganda. That government that is hunting its citizens is a government that is being supported by the action of these countries in the region and by the international community.
After all that happened to Dr. Riek Machar, my understanding is that he went back to South Africa. What is his legal status now?
My understanding is that the government of South Africa is temporarily hosting Dr. Riek Machar as a visitor while he is there for medical treatment. And that at the end of his treatment, he is supposed to find a place where he will go to, because I do not think that South Africa will be willing and able to host him for a very long time.
And what are the legal implications of this peace agreement? Because the peace agreement was signed between Dr. Riek Machar and the government in Juba and other stakeholders, with one party now sitting on the fence and the others are saying that they are implementing the agreement. What is the legal implication of that?
By isolating the second main party to the agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan, what the guarantors of that agreement has communicated to South Sudanese is that agreement is not just dead, it's clinically so. So we do not have a peace agreement at the moment in the absence of the parties that signed that peace agreement.
President Kiir will say he's implementing the peace agreement with Taban Dengai, who is representing the SPLM-IO.
I really cannot deny the government in Juba of their right to self-delusion. They're entitled to their opinion, but as a legal expert and with good knowledge of how peace agreement works, you really cannot sign peace agreement between yourselves, right? Taban Deng is, by all standards, part of the government. How does the government sign an agreement with itself? The agreement is signed with IO. IO under the chairperson of Riek Machar. Riek Machar is not in Juba. His people are not part of the agreement, I mean, of the government of national unity. So how can you be implementing a peace agreement that does not exist in the first place?
That's Remember Mia Ming, a lecturer and legal expert at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He was speaking to John Tanza yesterday from Accra, Ghana. One of four armed groups in Sudan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, has agreed to end and prevent the recruitment and use of children in conflict. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the group signed an action plan for carrying out the agreement.
To date, 59 armed groups and government forces are listed in the UN Secretary General's report on children and armed conflict as having committed grave violations against children. The violations include killing and maiming, attacks on schools and hospitals, sexual violence, recruitment and abduction of children. By signing the action plan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North hopes to get itself off the list. The UN Special Representative for the Secretary General on Children and Armed Conflict, Leila Zarugi, says the list is a kind of prod to armed groups.
One party to conflict is ready to cooperate, is ready to stop the violation. I would like to encourage them to stop the violation, move forward, rather than blaming them. If people don't act, then we name and shame.
Implementation of the action plan will begin as soon as the UN Children's Fund, which is the lead agency in this process, and its partners gain access to the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile State, where the SPLMN is located. UN aid agencies have not had access to those areas for about 5 years, a situation the SPLMN blames on the Sudanese government. Once the UN is able to reach the areas, Zarugi says aid workers will screen the troops to see how many children are in the ranks of the armed group. SPLMN Chairman Malik Aga tells VOA that a United Nations report in 2012 had listed 11 children as having been recruited, but a more recent report, he says, puts that number at 4.
The problem is not the number, whether it's 1 or 10, that's not the problem. The problem is the principle. Does the child, whether they are 2 or 3, whatever number, that deserve not to be subjected to hazards and his life subjected to difficulties and combat areas. And I think that is a matter of principle, not a matter of number.
UNICEF will oversee the demobilization and reintegration of the child soldiers into their local communities. The agency will trace the children's families and provide them with education and psychological care to help them cope with their trauma. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Sudan says it welcomes the decision by the SPLM North to end the recruitment and use of child soldiers. Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal tells VOA's James Buddy the news is especially welcome since his government has captured child soldiers who he says were used by the rebels as human shields.
Actually, we are very happy to hear that because many times have been children involved in the rebel movement in Darfur and in the SPLA North, and we arrested actually many of the children and we released them and we went to school. Now we are glad that they stopped this and they signed, and if it practical field. They didn't do this. It's a good thing, actually. We appreciate that.
There's also the Justice and Equality Movement and the Sudan Liberation Army. They are also fighting your government. Do you think they also use children as soldiers?
Yes, they use children. They actually arrested more than 300 of the children and have been released by forgiveness by the president last summer. And also when the attack in Durban, also we have arrested many children, actually, under 18. And they used to do this because now they couldn't recruit people, so they are being kidnapped children and they recruit them as soldiers.
Of course, Minister, the SPLM North had accused your government of using chemical weapons on civilians in Darfur.
This is a lie. This is a lie, a big lie. And we didn't actually have chemical weapons. We didn't use it at all since 1955. And because they have been defeated and they have no now grounds in Darfur, they are using this. They said before there is a massive fire. Rape, now they are saying about chemical weapons, and all these are lies. They know this. And you know, the enemy army, they said that they have 20,000 soldiers in Darfur. They never heard. Actually, they are moving on all Darfur. They have never heard or seen these chemical weapons. This is just a lie.
Minister, there's a story that said Wednesday your security forces arrested, I think, four opposition figures. Any reaction?
Actually, they have not been arrested. They have been called to the headquarters of the security. They inquired about certain things and they have been released. Nobody is detained from the, you know, the leftist party.
That was VOA's James Buddy speaking to Ahmed Bilal from Khartoum yesterday. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus. On the Voice of America, there's been a significant rise in the number of South Sudanese IDPs crossing into neighboring countries. What are officials doing to deal with the growing number of IDPs? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you able to communicate with friends and family overseas?
Not frequently, yeah, but once in a while I communicate through phones, through internet with my sisters, my brothers.
Very well, through WhatsApp, Imo, and through phone calls. We communicate regularly.
Yes, I do a lot, but not every time. Only sometimes when there are issues, I need to talk to them. Or hell is whenever sometime they need to confirm something where I am.
Most of the time they do the calling, but sometimes through the internet applications like Yahoo Chat, we are able to communicate.
Before was not easy, but now the world of technology, so we just use Facebook, Twitter, we can communicate with phones.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
Starting December 1st, join South Sudan in Focus host John Tanza and members of the South Sudanese community for a discussion about how hate speech is threatening to undermine coexistence among South Sudanese, both at home and abroad.
We are all South Sudanese, and there is no way we can make it without each other. We are all in the same boat. Either we sing together or we are safe together.
If we keep on saying that we want revenge, then this hate is not going to stop.
Your degree is a responsibility to pass on to the next generation.
The conversations amongst the elders really influence the younger generations that are following
the way we communicate with each other.
Tune in to South Sudan in Focus Monday through Friday to hear voices from home and the diaspora discussing hate speech and its implications on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The UN Agency for Migration, IOM, is concerned about the rising number of internally displaced persons, or IDPs, across South Sudan. The UN says as conditions deteriorate, aid agencies are finding it increasingly difficult to reach the most vulnerable. Waki Simon Mudu has this report from Juba.
IOM says nearly 2 million people have been internally displaced since the conflict broke out in South Sudan in late 2013. IOM officials say even though a peace agreement was signed by the warring parties more than a year ago, tens of thousands of people continue to flee their homes because of ongoing fighting between government and armed opposition forces. More than 212,000 internally displaced persons are being hosted at various Protection of Civilians or POC sites across the country, according to IOM Communications Officer Ashley McLalin.
We have seen an increase at the Bentu Protection of Civilians site, where there are approximately 108,000 IDPs. Since the end of October, approximately 7,000 have arrived.
Many people from Wau have also been displaced from their homes. McLalin says since fighting broke out in Wau in June, more than 40,000 people were forced to flee their homes in Wau town. She says many of Wau's IDPs are being hosted at a UN camp, churches, and at the South Sudan Red Cross compound. Last week alone, the IOM registered 170 new people escaping violence in Wau. McLalin says the ongoing violence and a lack of basic necessities like food and water are driving civilians away from their homes.
You know, the conflict has now reached most parts of the country. There are many different groups fighting. For us, the major concern is what people are facing on the ground. It could be clashes between government forces, opposition forces, other armed actors. We know there are a multitude of them in the country, and often civilians are caught in the crossfire. They're caught in the middle of these battles.
Fighting continues in several other areas, including Lier, forcing hundreds of other civilians to flee their villages. McLalin says aid agencies are unable to reach some of the newly displaced people in many areas across the country.
We often face constraints from armed actors or officials. They often change what they need for us to reach places and make it very difficult. It could be bureaucratic, it could be violence that just sort of keep humanitarian actors from reaching those that need assistance the most.
The government denies it is obstructing aid workers from reaching the vulnerable people in urgent need of assistance. Akol Paul Kordid is South Sudan's Deputy Information Minister.
There is no way, therefore, the government can obstruct the process of humanitarian organizations trying their best to reach the people, and we have been working closely with these humanitarian agencies to eradicate this call and to enhance the process of humanitarian delivery.
2 weeks ago, President Salva Kiir formed a committee to remove all obstacles in the way of delivering humanitarian assistance across the country. IOM says nearly 3 million South Sudanese have fled their homes in the past 3 years. Of that total, 1.1 million have sought shelter in Uganda, Kenya, Sudan, and Ethiopia. Just since July, when fighting broke out in the capital Juba, the UN says more than 360,000 people fled the country. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
As thousands of South Sudanese continue to flee to Uganda every day, they join past generations of fellow countrymen who have made Uganda their home. Simon Peter Apiku has the story for VOA from Kampala.
Most South Sudanese immigrants are descendants of the Sudanese who first came to Uganda toward the end of the 19th century as soldiers attached to the German explorer Emin Pasha, or members of the King's African Rifles, a British colonial regiment comprised of soldiers from territories in then British East Africa. James Taban fled his village in Pagari in South Sudan's eastern equatorial region following the outbreak of Sudan's first civil war in 1955. Now in his late 60s, Taban is a resident of Uganda's Kayunga district. Speaking in Madi, he says, when southern Sudanese troops mutinied in Torit in 1955, trouble quickly spread to his village, where a mob attacked and killed a northern Sudanese official.
After an Arab was killed in our area, the authorities arrested my father and many people in our village and took them to Torit. Before he left, my father gave instruction that I and my brother Aruga leave the village at once and go to Jinja in Uganda.
Taban says he arrived in Jinja, about 80 kilometers from Kampala, as a young boy in his early teens. He says his first job was for a British mechanic working for the Kilembe mines. Taban says 2 years later, he moved to Kampala and remained there for 12 years, doing various odd jobs for Indians. He returned to Jinja towards the end of the 1960s as a supervisor at an Indian company supplying construction materials to other companies. When the company built the hospital in Kayunga and later a road connecting the town to Jinja, Taban settled with his new Ugandan wife in the district where he has remained for more than 40 years. Taban says he has never returned to his village in Pagiri, although he hopes to take his 9 children there one day.
Even if I cannot take all of them, I still wanted to go with 1 or 2 children so that they get to know our village and relatives. But the problem now is that I do not know anybody there and nobody in the village remembers me.
Taban says the arrival of many other Mali people in Jinja over the years has enabled him to continue to speak the Mali language, but he concedes none of his children understands the language. His family communicates in Luganda, the language of the inhabitants of the Buganda Kingdom. 62-year-old Ibrahim Lincoln Noah, a resident of Bombo, a small town about 30 kilometers from Kampala, says he learned about his origin from his grandfather, who came to Uganda as a young man.
My grandfather told me he was a Bari. Those are stories he used to tell us. And they came from Sudan around Juba.
The inhabitants of Bombo descended from Sudanese immigrants. Most of them, including Hassan Hussein Musa, come from the Equatorial region.
My grandfather, the late Musa Bobur, migrated from Kajikeji. He came, stayed in Arua, he bought land there, and eventually he came to Bombo, bought land here. Until his death, actually, his family was divided. Some remained in Arua and others came this way.
When conflict intensified in Sudan in the early 1960s and refugees began fleeing into Uganda, a group of students sheltered in Bombo. University of Juba professor Alfred Sebit Lokuji was among them. Lokuji, who lives in Bombo, says many new refugees are surprised to hear the story of the people of Bombo.
Maybe it was a coincidence that South Sudanese were brought to Bombo, where there were people who are sometimes known as Sudanese and specifically sometimes as Nubians. And we quickly found out that among the Nubians, the families still trace their origins in South Sudan. Some of them will tell you they are Bari, and even what clan. There are a lot who say they are of the Logura clan, which is my clan.
These Sudanese are now recognized as Nubians, which is listed as one of Uganda's nationalities, and all converted to Islam. Noah says, aside from the fact that his ancestors came from the Bari ethnic group in Central Equatorial region, nothing remains in them of the Bari culture. Musa agrees.
The culture is lost. The names are lost. If you look at our setup here in Bombo, the Nubian community, a child is given one name, and it's a religious name. Say, if you are Mustafa and your father is Abbas, automatically you become Mustafa Abbas.
Noah fears that as people adapt new identities and cultures, future generations will lose interest and sever ties with their ancestral home. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Apiku in Kampala, Uganda.
We leave you with an uplifting story today about some South Sudanese in Uganda who play football to unite young people from various ethnic groups and talk peacefully about issues affecting their country. From Uganda's Kampala, Mugumi Davis Wakarinj has this report for VOA.
Drop, it's okay. Referee,
Coach Joseph Nashon shouts instructions to his Budwe Football Club players on the field at Kampala St. Lawrence University. The team is squaring off against another group of young men made up of South Sudanese from various parts of the Equatorial region. The pitch is muddy, but Nashon says the players are enjoying the game and putting their troubles aside.
We're here to still show our brothers that we want to be together. Despite the fact that we are in Uganda, we want to live as one people. The fact is there is conflict and insecurity going back in our homes. We can't keep on thinking about it all the time. We want to be also refreshing our mind by playing football.
Nashon, who is a second-year public health student at the Kampala-based African Population Institute, says games like this have the power to break the divide between different South Sudanese ethnic communities who ordinarily would not talk to each other in South Sudan.
Before like the game started, I found there was an interaction. People were crossing over and greeting one another. Oh, I've not seen you for a long time. Meaning there is kind of peace that exists between the two.
Nashon says the young generation must change the mentality of resorting to violence to resolve their differences. St. Lawrence University student Aquila Edward helps organize the soccer games which attract South Sudanese from all over Uganda. Edward, who hails from the Budwe State capital Yambio, says all ethnic tensions are forgotten on the field.
As we are here as footballers, after playing, we have to interact with each other to know, and by doing so, then we shall have unity, and the unity will be taken back home.
George Martin, a computer engineering student at St. Lawrence University, is a player with the Budwe team.
I don't care if it's Nuer, Dinka, or Bari, or any other tribe. So all I care is that we need to come up together. We need to join ourselves together in order to have peace, and we play a fair game as we are doing right now. So I think there's no argument, as you can see. There's no argument, there's no quarreling, there's no fight, there's nothing. So we are just playing fair game.
Player Samuel Atere's home is in your state, formerly part of Lake State. Atere captained the team representing non-Equatorial South Sudanese who live in the Equatorial region. By playing on the team, Atere says he has been able to make many new friends.
If we go as here and we meet ourselves in Juba, by the way, it is actually very good. We can remember ourselves that this one show that it is our player we have ever been playing with them, and this one will give us a love for each other.
23-year-old Innocent Birara Emmanuel from Yei is one of several fans watching the game. Emmanuel says, aside from uniting different South Sudanese factions, the games also allow players to hone their skills.
It's just exciting and fantastic for me to watch my own country mates playing a soccer in a country like this, Uganda. Specifically, I'm seeing some talent here that if put in place in practice, can make a very good team to our country, South Sudan.
The match ended by each team scoring 2 goals. Many of the players here say once they graduate from university, they plan to go home and help fix South Sudan's political problems. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
And that's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song One People, One Nation by Isaka Number One. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. From all of us here at VOA, we hope you have a peaceful weekend. And join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Togetherness is all we need. Peace and harmony. Shakin Mafi Iyata Abuwa Hit Bigeni Fibet Kepia Kwani Kore Kore Mafi Lakabata Mafi. Listen. One people, one nation, one land.